So 2 weeks ago, we started the topic of issues in Mechiras Chametz, where we decided to go into a little bit more depth into some of the history and some of the discussions of Mechiras Chametz to see how far we could get. And we got to a certain point, and we're still in the zone for the selling of Chametz. So I thought we would continue a little bit and say some more issues, and again, see how far we get. And we'll do what we can. So I think we're in the middle of discussing the second of the three conditions, the conditions that were suggested by the Rishonim to explain what was meant by the clause that the Rishonim were paskening like the Tosefta, which is the basis for our Mechiras Chametz. The Tosefta describes someone who is traveling when Pesach approaches and he has his whole stash of Chametz with him. So apparently it's an option to transfer the Chametz that he has to a non-Jewish fellow traveler and then to reobtain the Chametz afterwards, but the Rishonim who quote this, they have a condition. Where the condition comes from, it's not clear. Maybe it was a Girsa, maybe the Rishonim put it in. It's not 100% clear where it came from, but the condition is Bilvad Shelo Yarim, as long as it's not a Harama. So what exactly it means by a Harama, as we'll see, itself is subject to a lot of interpretation. Some kind of trickery or some kind of evasion or some kind of falsehood or any combination of the above, all not clear. But apparently there's this condition that if you want to use this maneuver of transferring your chametz and getting it back, it can only be done under the condition that you're not doing a harama. So what's called a harama and what isn't? So that's a good question. The Beis Yosef quotes the Rabbeinu Yerucham that it seems like the whole thing is a harama, and yet apparently it's acceptable. So what do we mean if we say that there's this condition that it not be a harama? So we mentioned that the first interpretation is not good for us, but luckily it's not accepted la halacha. That's the interpretation of the Ritva, that it means that you shouldn't do it every year. So that would be a problem, but that's not brought la halacha at all. And then the second opinion was the one we discussed in more detail, and that is that you have to take it out of your house. So that seems like it's a problem for us, but in practice it isn't, because the way that's been developed by the poskim is that it means that we should put it in a separate area in our house that we then lease out and provide access to. And we talked a little bit about those conditions and why they're there and what that is meant to address. So part of that was the question of why that condition is there. And before we finished the last time, we got into an interesting discussion that the Avnezer had raised, that this idea of leasing out your house, that was really a later development on top of that, because the Bach had really said to sell part of your house where the Chametz is, and the Avnezer and others objected to that because they thought that was a super harama, that was a real harama, because you can sell your Chametz, but to sell your house partially and temporarily, that no one does, that has no meaning to it. So to say you're living in your house but you're selling your basement for a week, that has no significance, and that's a complete harama, and he thought that was really undermining the whole thing. So the only way for that to have meaning would be to lease out your chametz, lease out the area where the chametz is, and that has some meaning, some reality to it. And there was a whole debate about that, and that was where we left off. And part of that was also to address another kind of harama within a harama kind of question, that doesn't this seem a little sketchy, that if the original condition was it had to be taken out of your house, and now they're saying, well, not really taken out, but just put it in a separate section and leased out that section and give them a key. You don't really have to give them a key. You just have to tell them where the key is, and you don't even have to do that as long as you don't take away the key on purpose, etc., etc. So all of that seems to be moving farther and farther away from the original formulation. So a part of appreciating that is that it's about addressing what the issue was to begin with, because why should it be a concern that you have to take the chametz out of your house, given that the Gemara says in the first parak of Pesachim that chametz of a non-Jew that's in the house of a Jew is not a violation of Bayi Ra Bayi Matzei. So if you sell your chametz and then leave it in your own house, so that shouldn't be a problem anyway. So why do we have this idea that it has to be moved out of your house? So that's a discussion many Sfarim have, Chazon Ish and others, and there are various suggestions, and it seems that it itself is a chumra, possibly motivated by the concern that maybe since you are going to reacquire the chametz, so there's a greater risk here, and that maybe we are worried that you will indeed eat the chametz, so therefore we have to take extra steps to address that. And that is then accomplished through the modified version, which had to be modified because given the involvement of the Jews in the liquor industry and the heavy equipment that was connected to that and the inventories that were connected to that, it became less practical to actually move that. And therefore, a formulation was necessary that would address that in that specific format. So that's all as far as the second condition is concerned. But the third condition is one that we do stick to, and that is, and this is probably the one that is most likely accepted, lahalacha, and this may be itself in some of the editions of the Tosefta, and in the Yerushalmi, and the way the Karban Eidah understands the Yerushalmi, and that is that the gift, let's say if you're giving it to the non-Jew as a gift, it must be absolute, and it can't be conditioned on its return or on anything else. So the language in some of the sources is a Matana Gemura, which is explained as to exclude a Matana Amanas Lahachzir, that you can't make this transaction contingent on anything else. So here, again, even though we do accept that condition, the same question can be asked as to why, because the Gemara has, in a number of places, the discussion of what is the status of Matana Amanas Lahachzir, and the conclusion in general is that Matana Amanas Lahachzir Shmei Matana, that such a Matana is considered to be effective, and during the term of ownership, it is actual complete ownership. So even if I give you something and tell you that a week from now you have to give it back to me, but during that week, it is yours. So why it is that it can't be Amatana Manas Lahachzir is not obvious. So here you have various suggestions as to what the issue is. So there are some who feel like it's a more fundamental concern, such as the Radbaz in his Shuvas, where he seems to see it as something more fundamental, that maybe you are therefore going to require the purchaser to guard the chametz if he thinks he's got to give it back under these circumstances the same way he got it. So now he has to watch it for you, and that means it's more of a Bayi Ra Bayi Matzei concern. And others say it a little bit more, that anything that is contingent means it's not clear that it's final. It means that it's dependent on something. And maybe that's already not satisfactory as far as Bayi Ra Bayi Matzei, that it could be that it'll be shown later on to be null and void. It's a little paradoxical, because the way it'll be shown to be null and void is if he holds on to it. So if he holds on to it, then it'll be as if he never got it. So it's a little bit funny, but in a chanami, so maybe that's a concern. So later Sfarim said they don't understand why you should worry about that, because, okay, maybe that's true, but until that happens, then it is a matana, so why do we have to worry about what might happen? So whether or not this is really something that actually undermines the nature of the sale is somewhat of a debate. And there are others who feel like it's just too much of a harama at that point, that to actually put into the sale itself a condition that it has to be returned, that's just too much of a joke. That's already maybe Mishum Chumrat D'Chametz. That's already going to be too much. And that's, for example, how you see in Hagos Maimini and Magen Avram. And even the Radbaz we mentioned a minute ago was explaining differently, but in other tshuvas he seems to also see it like that. So which explanation you say does make a difference, because if we're saying that you may be calling into question the validity of the sale, so then that's a big deal, because then that means that the original owner is going to maintain ownership of the chametz, and it's going to be chametz she'avar lav ha'pesach. So that's certainly a higher stakes. If it's just that this is not appropriate given the chumra of chametz, and probably an issue on a level midrabanan, so it's not right to do, but it wouldn't have all of the ramifications of a invalid sale. So that's important to figure out. The Trumas Hadeshin in a tshuva, so he talks about this idea that it has to be an absolute sale that's not contingent on return. But he still makes it clear that it doesn't matter that you're sure you will get it back. So the fact that the recipient or the buyer is somebody who the Jew is friendly with, and he understands that he is going to preserve it to give it back to him, and it's clear that he fully intends to do so, all of that is fine. We don't care that the metzias is going to come back to you. What we care is that that shouldn't be a condition. And all of that, that's short of that, but still results in your knowing that you're going to get it back, that's okay. And the Trumas Hadeshin has the language, v'chein ro'i laharos, that this is okay, and this is how to paskin, and indeed, that's what we do. And Beis Yosef quotes that, and that's recorded in Shulchan Aruch. So nowadays, we do it like that, where there's even a language that you find in some of the texts, which basically conveys to the buyer that he should know if any other purchaser comes along that he shouldn't be tempted, because he'll get a better deal from the original Jew, and that's all to be expected, as long as it's not an absolute tenai, as long as it's not an absolute condition. Nowadays, the way we generally do it is the purchaser makes what amounts to a down payment on the chametz. And ultimately, he's going to have to pay the whole thing. And certainly, if he wants to keep the chametz, or if he wants to keep any part of the chametz, he's got to pay the value of that chametz. And we give him a week to come up with the money to pay the whole value. And then if he chooses not to, or he says doesn't have the money, so then in order to give him an option to relieve him of that big debt, so we allow him to sell it back to us. But that's a new transaction. And very crucially, it's not that the original sale was contingent on that. And that would be a huge mistake, because if the sale was contingent on that, then that would be something would invalidate the whole sale of Mafreya. So it's very important that this is even a bigger deal than not making it Matan Almanas L'Hachzir. So there's two possible contingencies that we're talking about here, just to be clear. So one is contingent on returning it afterwards. So that is what we don't do, even though if you did do it, it's not clear why it should be a problem. But still, we're machmir not to do that anyway. But the second contingency on a full payment afterwards, that would be a real problem, because he generally does not pay for the whole chametz afterwards. So if we were making a contingent on that, that would actually invalidate the whole sale retroactively. And that would be a very serious mistake. So when we use the down payment method, the down payment means that with that down payment, the chametz is transferred absolutely. And the rest of the money is there as a chov. And if he wants to get out of the chov a week later, then he has that option of transferring it back. But they also used to do it a little differently, where they would sell the chametz at, let's say, 1% of the value, and after Pesach, come back and buy it back at, let's say, 2% of the value, so to give the purchaser a little bit for his trouble. So this led to some problems, and there was a fascinating tshuva of the Masas Binyamin. That was Rabbi Binyamin Aaron Solnik, who lived in the 1500s, died in 1620. So he has a fascinating tshuva where he discussed a problem that he said was really troubling him. He couldn't sleep at night. He didn't know what to do about this problem because they would sell the chametz at this fraction of a price and then plan to buy it back afterwards at a little bit more. And what would happen was that after Pesach, so there would be an issue that unscrupulous Jews, other Jews, would swoop in and buy the chametz away for themselves at, let's say, 3% of the value, a little bit more than what was originally paid. And they would get the whole business of the first Jew. So that was terrible. And he wrote that he didn't know what to do about this because he felt stuck that on the one hand, he has to respect the integrity of the sale, that he can't make the sale contingent on anything, so he can't tell the purchaser what to do. He can't tell the purchaser that he's got to sell it back to the first guy. Now, there's an interesting discussion some of the Sfarim have that is actually considered to be a big problem, that there are some people who have Shirayim from a Chassidus Rebbe, and it's Chametz. And they want to preserve this. It's a cherished keepsake. And the problem is, how do you do that? Because if you want to sell that, so you're basically then going to tell the purchaser that this is something of great value to you, and he's going to hopefully give it back to you in its original state. So there are those who feel that that's pretty much impossible to do, because that's essentially telling him he's got to return it as is. So there's a tshuva about that in the Ruga Sabosa, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe had a tshuva about that that was published in the Sefer Shulchan Menachem, and they thought that that was indeed a big issue. They had various other suggestions how to deal with it, but basically making this contingent arrangement, or making any arrangement where it's essentially a condition that he has to return it in perfect shape, is going to be problematic. So what could the Masas Binyamin do here that he can't tie the hands of the purchaser at all? But if other Jews come in and swoop in and make it impossible, practically speaking, for Mechiras Chametz to take place, then what's he going to do? So the Jews need Mechiras Chametz to survive. They're all in the liquor business. But how is he going to preserve the integrity of the sale? So he wrote he couldn't sleep at night. And then he eventually came up with a brilliant solution. He basically threaded the needle by applying some of the Gemaras you find in Baba Basra and elsewhere, which are essentially protectionist as far as competition. So, for example, some of them are more complicated than this, but just to give a little bit of a taste of it. So some of them talk about if a person was mahafich b'charara, if a person had spread out a net in order to catch fish, and then somebody else swoops in and takes his fish, so that's a problem. So it's quoted in the context of the unfair competition sugyas. So the whole idea is that when somebody is invested in a certain market, and then somebody else comes in and takes the benefits of that market away from the person who's put in the effort, so then that's wrong to do, and Beis Din can enforce it. So this is much worse than that. Here, somebody has his whole inventory and his whole business, and somebody else then is going to then just take that and use that for his own purposes, so it seems to be much worse than that. And the Masas Binyamin understood that the Bate Din can enforce this against the potential of other Jews doing that, but it wouldn't be applied against the seller, it would be applied against these other Jews. So it would preserve the autonomy of the seller to do whatever he wants, but it wouldn't stop the other Jews, would stop the other Jews from coming in and being the buyers. So he threaded that needle very carefully, and that was his solution. So it's a fascinating tshuva. as far as that's concerned. So that's one discussion. There's also a very interesting balance that you see in the tshuva of the Sefer Bigdei Yesha that was written by Rav Shmuel ben Yosef Halevi, where he was afraid about how to understand this very small amount that's paid as a down payment, especially if the purchaser is destitute. So if there's no real possibility that he's going to be able to make the down payment, which is, we make the whole payment, so how much should we worry about that? This is a very big issue, because probably most of the shuls in the world use people who are not really in a position to pay for all the chametz. So the notable exception to this is Rabbi Willig, who has always been careful to use a purchaser who is a capable businessman, who can put together, at least even if he can't do it out of his own pocket, but can put together a group of people who could pay for the whole packages of chametz if they wanted to. And he actually feels that's likuva. He feels that that is necessary in order for it to work, which would be a significant problem if that's the case, because many other shuls certainly don't do that. It happens to be Rabbi Willig's Mechira involves many, many shuls together, so it covers a lot of people, but it doesn't cover every shul in the world, so there are certainly other shuls that are selling to people who aren't so wealthy. And how do we feel about that? So the Bigdei Yesha has this tshuva where he writes that you can't have any harama at all in Bechiras Chametz. You can't have anything that is fake. And he explains the whole thing. He puts forward a model to explain why everybody's motivation makes sense and why everything fits. And he asks a number of questions and he answers them all in a way where everything fits and there shouldn't be any haram at all. He says like this. He says, first of all, what's going on with the Jewish guy? Why is he selling to this poor person for a fraction of the cost? And if it's a down payment he can't pay, if it's a fraction, why is he doing that? Why, okay, he wants to sell his chametz, but why doesn't he want to sell his chametz for as much as he can get, not to other people? So essentially he explains like this. That yes, Naniach the Jew would like to sell his chametz, and he'd be happy to sell his chametz forever for the full value. But it's hard for him to find a purchaser who will pay that full value. And Pesach is coming. So he's interested in finding the highest possible buyer he can, but he doesn't have an ability to do that before Pesach. So he approaches this other non-Jew who he knows and trusts, and says, here's the deal. So I will sell to you the chametz at a down payment. So you only have to pay me a very small amount. And you're taking on the responsibility for the whole value, which understandably you yourself can't afford. But you have a week to try to find a buyer who will pay for the whole thing. If you find a buyer, so then he'll pay you, and then you can pay me out of that money, and we'll all be happy. So I'll get the whole value for my chametz, you'll get the profit as the middleman, and he'll get the chametz he wants to buy. And then if, come the end of Pesach, you haven't found anybody, okay, so then I'll agree to buy it back from you, and I'll give you a little bit extra for your trouble, so it was worth your while. And that'll be the end. And therefore, everyone's motivations make sense. And it's not chametz she'avel af ha-Pesach, because it was in the ownership of this non-Jewish agent the whole time. But there's no haram at all there, so everything makes sense, because theoretically, I'm open to getting the full payment for my chametz if somebody comes through. If not, then okay, I tried, and it wasn't in my ownership over the course of Pesach. And the purchaser, it doesn't really matter whether he personally can afford it, because he has an interest in potentially finding somebody who can, in which case he will get the profit as the middleman. And if not, then okay, he gets paid for his trouble, so his motivations make sense. It's a win-win for him, it's a win-win for me, it's potentially a win for the third guy, and no harama anywhere. That's how he that's how he understood it. So it's a fascinating model of the whole thing, which doesn't necessarily reflect every understanding of every Mechiras Chametz that's ever happened in history, but it's certainly a very fascinating way of understanding the whole picture and putting together the various parts. So that's one particular way of looking at it. So this whole question of Mechiras Chametz as a harama or not is an issue which we see the Rishonim took up and had different conceptions, even though it was something that then kind of resurfaced in the 1700s, that the Bechor Shor, the author of Chashuv Sefer on Shechita and Chulin, called the Tvua Shor, Rav Alexander Shor, in the 1700s, who was very, very influential, and in addition to his own stature, had many prominent descendants, probably most so his grandson was the Beis Ephraim, and he was very involved in advancing his position here. So the Bechor Shor is often quoted as the big enemy of the Mechiras Chametz plan as a harama. Although whether he's being accurately quoted is a little bit up for debate, as we'll see. But he had a three-point position. And his position was as follows, that Mechiras Chametz, it's not clear that this is actually an accurate representation of it, as I'll explain in a second, but this is the way it's quoted, is that Mechiras Chametz is a harama, and haramos are only acceptable for rabbinic law. This is based on the Gemara Masechet Shabbos. Whether the comparison is fitting or not depends on how you understand what he's getting at. But that language theoretically appears in the Gemara and Shabbos, but it's a very different context unless you see things a certain way. But that's the second principle here, that haramos are only acceptable when dealing with rabbinic law. It's premise number two. And premise number three is that, nonetheless, our Mechiras Chametz is okay because we're dealing, indeed, with a Din D'Rabbanan. What do you mean? Isn't Bali Rabbi Yimatze a Din Min HaTorah? So to that he says, no, it's D'Rabbanan, because the Gemara says in the first parak of Pesachim, that as far as the din daraisa ba'ira ba'imatze, that if there is bittul done, as the halacha requires, so that satisfies the issue of ba'ira ba'imatze in a level minatorah. That's why the Gemara explains why bedikas chametz only is a din midrabanan, because you don't have to worry that you're potentially in violation of Bayira Bayimatze for the Chametz that you didn't otherwise know about, because you did Bittul. So that principle applies here to say, okay, our Chametz is Drabanan, and therefore, despite the fact that Mechiras Chametz is a Haram, and Haramas are only good by Drabanans, could still work. So that last premise was also questionable, big time, as many objected to it, because to say that the Mechiras Chametz is okay because Bittul knocks it down to the Rabbanans is very problematic, as many understood, because the Bittul and the Mechira are presumably not dealing with the same Chametz. That the Bittul Chametz is done on the Chametz that's under the couch that you don't know about, that you don't plan on ever seeing again. And the chametz that you sell, it's very hard to say that that could be included in the bittul, because if you're going to do business with it, you're going to transact with it. So how could it make sense to say that you're mevatel that kafir the aron, you have nothing to do with it? And in fact, there are those who say that even suggesting that, even thinking that, may undo your whole bittul, because you're now saying that you're interested in it. So it seems like it's a contradiction in terms to say that the same chametz is both batel and subject to mechira. And this is part of a whole discussion in general in Bung Poskim as to what should happen first. That some understand that bichlal, the bittel, has to be done after the mechira, because any mechira is going to undo the bittel. So that's itself a whole discussion, but certainly it seems that it's hard to say that the chametz that's sold is part of the bittel, and therefore only subject to a din derabbanan. So those were the three postulates of the Bechor Shor, and there basically are four attitudes towards these three postulates. So there are those who accept all three postulates. Mecheres Chametz is Harama, and Haramas are only good for the Rabbanans, but Betzel knocks it down to Rabbanan. There are those who disagree with all three and say Mecheres Chametz is not a Harama, there's no such rule limiting Haramas, and that's a good thing because we're dealing here with an Isser Daraisa, so if you want to use Mecheres Chametz, you have to man up and be okay with using that for Daraisas. So they disagree with all three of the principles. And there are those who split and accept two and not third, or the other way around. So they split Lekula or Lechumra. There are probably many who split Lechumra, don't necessarily know that that's what they're doing. They may not have heard of the Bechor Shor, but they're essentially accepting two out of the three principles, because there probably are many who feel that there's something that they don't feel totally comfortable about with Mechiras Chametz and feel that it's not appropriate for Torah law, but therefore will only deal with Dinei Derabbanan, but they don't accept this third premise that the Bittel accomplishes that, and therefore they have to look to something else. So there's a shita that many have, that they only sell chametz that is itself midrabanan, and they don't sell chametz gomer. So that, for example, may be a split approach towards the Bechor Shor's three rules, taking the first two and not the third. That's one possibility. There are some who say, by the way, that the issue that we mentioned at the very beginning tonight, the question of why do you have to move it out of your house? So what is that necessary for? So some suggest that that's because of a split attitude towards the Bechor Shor, that maybe they're also looking for other ways to knock the Isser down to a Derabbanan, and they don't want to rely on the Bittel, and that maybe Chametz that is taken outside of your house already, at worst, is going to be an Isser Derabbanan of Bayra Bayimatze, and therefore that allows the Mechira to work. That's how some suggest. Sternbach and others have suggestions along those lines. So there are those who split Lechumra, and there are also some who split Lekula, meaning they only accept his third rule, that the Bittel knocks it down to the Rabbanan, and therefore they're willing to accept leniencies in the Mechira, because, oh, we're dealing with a Rabbanan here, so therefore we can accept Kulas. So you have these four different attitudes to the three rules of the Bechor Shor. But this whole question of whether Mechiras Chametz is a Harama or not, so as we see, is something that the Rishonim already talked about. They already had this whole condition that it shouldn't be a Harama, and they figured out what it is that would make it a Harama or not a Harama, and addressed that. And it's important also to appreciate that the Bechor Shor himself, it's not clear that that's really what he was saying, and that he may be somewhat incompletely quoted when that position is attributed to him. And this is something the Stechamed points out, and maybe others will point this out also, like in the Verhete, which was also written by a member of the extended family of the Bechor Shor, points this out as well. That if you look in the language of the Bechor Shor in his conclusion, he may actually take that position, because he wasn't actually talking about Mechiras Chametz in his original complaint. He was talking about something else. He was talking about the fact that they had a practice going on there that they would sell the animals. That the concern was the feed for the animals was Chametz, and the alternative was very schwach. So for a week, they would eat this non-chametz feed, they would get very skinny. So in order to prevent that temporary devaluation of the animals, they would sell the animals to non-Jews, who would then feed these animals chametz. And B'chor Shor was very upset about that, because he said, that's a total joke. He says, that sale has no meaning to it. He says, that sale is a harama, because here these expensive animals are being sold to people who can't afford them, as we noted before, but they certainly can't afford these big animals, and they're not being moved at all into their property. So that whole thing has no credibility to it, and benefiting from chametz is an issur d'oraisa, so you can't allow that harama for an issur d'oraisa. But mechiras chametz itself, separately from his bittul point, he concedes there that that may be acceptable, because there, it's different calculation than the animals. So when it comes to the animals, he's saying, I can't believe that that's really a genuine sale, because of all those points that he mentioned, that just to save a little bit of devaluation temporarily, they're going to actually sell these expensive animals to people who can't afford them without moving them. That has no reality to it. But when it comes to the chametz itself, it says there, you only have two choices. Either you have to destroy it, or sell it sincerely. So given that those are the only two choices, so then maybe it's possible that indeed they are selling it sincerely, because the alternative is they just have to destroy it. So that's a much more drastic alternative. So maybe indeed that actually is sincere. So it could be that even the Bechor Shor himself didn't actually think that Mechiras Chametz itself is the harama. He was just worried about the selling of the animals. So the idea of his third position, that Bittel would allow for the sale to be treated a little bit more leniently, is problematic, as we noted, but there is another aspect to it that some point to. It's a question whether this helps or not, that there is a language of the Ran that's related to the Bittel point from a different perspective, because the question is, why does Bittel work? So, separate from the statement to the Gemara that Bittel has an effect on the din of Ba'yira Ba'yimotze, but the question is also asked, why does Bittel do anything in the first place? So, there's a machlokus Rishonim as to what Bittel is. So, some Rishonim understand that Bittel is a type of hefker, but other Rishonim feel that it doesn't meet the standards of Hefker, that Hefker has to be in front of three, and Hefker has to be public. You have to give others the opportunity to actually take what you're being mafkir. So how could it be that just declaring something to be worthless accomplishes anything? Does that work in any other area of halacha or law, that you just call something kafir da'ara and it turns into dust? Is that something that generally works? What mechanism is being used here? So the Ran has a yesod that the reason Bittel works is because the ownership of chametz is already a little bit funny. That this is based on the language the Gemara has in Bava Kamma and in Psachim, that there are some things, there's two things that really we don't actually own, but the halacha makes it as if we own for liability purposes, for bad things. And one is a bor b'rishos harabim, that normally I'm only liable for damages caused by my property, but there's a chiddush haTorah that I'm liable for a bor b'rishos harabim, that even though I don't own the public area where I made a pit, but that's still enough to make me liable if I make a pit in a public place. And the other is chametz on Pesach. Because presumably, and this is a whole discussion in the acronym, but presumably what the Gemara is getting at is something along the lines of what is the question of ownership when something is asur bahana. That the idea that you can actually have any kind of meaningful bilus over something that has no monetary value is a big question, because the question of what ownership in general means and entails. So it's possible that chametz doesn't really have a concept of ownership to begin with, because on Pesach it's asur b'hana. So we have a prohibition to own chametz. So the truth is, first of all, the Torah doesn't actually use the language of ownership. We relate to it as meaning ownership. It says, ba'ira ba'imatze. But presumably it's something along the lines of intermarriage, that the Torah prohibits intermarriage, even though Kedushin is in Tofes with a non-Jew. So we don't say, oh, okay, so fine, it's no problem, since there's no Chalus Kedushin, so there can't be any Yisr. So we understand that the Yisr of intermarriage means to act B'dar Chasnus, even though there's no Tfitzis Kedushin. So too, when it comes to the Yisr of owning Chametz on Pesach, it means to act with Bailus over Chametz, even though there may not really be ownership of Chametz on Pesach. So that could change the parameters to a certain extent. And that's how the Ran understands that since the ownership is already a little bit fuzzy, so that's why Bittul works. So that also may play a role to a certain extent in some kulas in Mechiras Chametz, for some who understand it that way. And there's another shuv, the Masas Binyamin, who invokes this in some context, says that there may be other issues in the sale that may sometimes be flawed, and that using this run may help. It's a question exactly when to use that and how far you can go with that, but there's a discussion in some poskim that if it turns out that a mechira was done with a flawed kinyan, or maybe even worse than that, so is there, and this, you know, sometimes there's nightmare situations for a rabbi, that let's say the rabbi loses the shtaros, things like that, so that's a whole discussion of itself, but sometimes somebody tries to sell chametz and he's not successful. If you're learning Daf Yomi now, so the Gemara is talking about the sugyas of transactions between Jews and non-Jews, and they're very complicated. So it's possible to do it wrong in a number of ways. So it was a discussion in the postgame about what should happen if you try to do a mechira and it turns out that it was wrong. Or what if somebody appoints the rabbi to the mechira and he does something wrong? So is there any relief for the original seller who thought he was selling his chametz, either for the violation of the Isser or for the status afterwards of the consequence of Chametz Shavuot of a Pesach? So there's an extensive literature about this, and if it comes up, so you should ask your local posek. But there are some who discuss this Masas Binyamin based on the Ran, that maybe because of the whole inferior kind of quasi-ownership that Chametz has in the first place, that maybe it's a kind of bittul, that the attempt to sell it is itself a kind of bittul, that even if you weren't going to include the sale in the bittul, but the fact that you thought you were selling your chametz, that is considered to be an effort towards at least the same thing as bittul, and maybe is enough to rely on b'di'evitz. That's a whole discussion. Again, if it comes up on Maisa, you should look into it. But there is a discussion in postgame to what extent it's possible to rely on that. So there's many other issues in Mechiras Chametz, many others, but I don't know how much more time we'll have between now and Pesach to discuss it. We could still reserve the right to say a little bit more after Pesach, as we've done in the past, but assuming this is the last opportunity we'll have before Pesach, we're usually off on Chol HaMoed. Next week, there isn't much of a week before Pesach starts. So, assuming that this is the last time before Pesach we have to talk about, I'll just mention that in terms of the hashkafa of Mechiras Chametz, that the fact that despite all of these controversies and accusations of harama, so the fact that much of Klal Yisrael has accepted Mechiras Chametz to a certain degree, or maybe a complete degree, could perhaps be explained by another comment of the Ran, that if we assume that, as the Ran says, that the reason the Torah prohibits ownership of Chametz on Pesach is really as a siag mehatorah to keep us away from eating Chametz on Pesach, which is the real concern. So perhaps we're making a statement here that there's two things that can keep us away from eating Chametz. One is simply not having any. And the other is, even if there is chametz in our house, But if it belongs to someone else, so then that will also keep us away. If there's going to be an Aveira of Gezel and taking the Chametz, so that will also keep us away. So the fact that they reacquire the Chametz afterwards doesn't have to bother us. The fact that the Chametz is in our house over the course of Pesach, it doesn't matter. As long as the title is transferred, so the ownership is with somebody else who could take it whenever he wants, so then it's off limits to us over the course of Pesach. And if it's off limits, then it accomplishes what it needs to accomplish, as long as we're careful to take it seriously in both parts of the equation. We're careful to take the Mechira seriously, which is reflected in the fact that over the centuries there is a constant ongoing effort to enhance all the details of the Mechira and to make it as serious as possible, and that we take the rules of Gasol secret seriously, and we understand that this is really off limits and that we're not allowed to take any liberties. So the combination of those two things will hopefully indeed keep us away from Chametz and fulfill the intent of the halacha, not just the letter of the law, but also the spirit of the law as well. And maybe we can also note that the Smak wrote that the Jews cannot have a geula, cannot have a redemption, if they're not perceived as people of honesty and integrity, because they'll be achil Hashem. Nations of the world will say, how can these Jews be redeemed if they're not honest? So if we're hoping for a geula, so then we have to get a reputation for being indeed honest. So perhaps this minig has developed that around this time of Pesach, when we focus on themes of Geula, so we intentionally engage in a transaction with the Umos HaOlam, and we go out of our way to show how much we value the integrity of that transaction, and we stake our whole kares on the integrity of that transaction. And that display should be a Kiddush Hashem, and that should bring us closer to the Geula. So in this tkufa right now, when the Geula is needed so profoundly and so much more felt the need than we've had in a long time, and the need for Kiddush Hashem is so profound, perhaps every little bit that we can get, and maybe there is some validity to this idea that we can use the practice of Mechiras Chametz to strengthen the goal of Kiddush Hashem and the display of honesty and integrity in the transactions, and in doing so, indeed, being the Kaddish and Shemayim, and take some small steps towards bringing that Geula that we so desperately seek at this time. So I wish you all a Chag Kasher v'Sameach, and very much hope that the next time we meet, the world will be a much better place.
Thank you.
Okay.